Coming to you from the lands of the Kulin Nation on ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Hello, I'm Beverly Wang. If you've ever suddenly lost a job, had a surprise, health diagnosis, or a relationship end, you know what it feels like to grapple with uncertainty. Or maybe you're thinking of making a big change, but fear of the unknown is holding you back from making a move, and now you feel stuck and uneasy. If this sounds familiar to you, let's explore whether it's possible to change your tolerance for venturing into the unknown. And in about 40 minutes' time, I'm going to ask the aunties whether bad friends deserve second chances. Let's talk. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't. How many times have you heard or used that proverb to explain why you prefer the status quo? Research backs this up. There's a University College London study that found that knowing you have a chance of getting a mild electric shock can feel more painful and stressful than when you're certain you'll be on the receiving end of a zap. Let's face it, though. Uncertainty is all around us, and our brains don't like it. It's an uncomfortable feeling. But what could you be missing out on when fear of the unknown drives decision-making? Today, my guests will argue that avoiding uncertainty comes at a cost, and there's practical steps to help you build your uncertainty tolerance. So let's get into it. And I want to welcome our guests, Simone Stolzoff, a journalist and author whose latest book is called How to Not Know: The Value of Uncertainty in a World That Demands Answers, and Sara O'Doherty, psychologist and president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Simone and Sara, welcome to you both. Simone, I'm going to start with you because it was your experience leaping into the unknown that kicked off your interest in uncertainty. Tell me about it.
There's a few different ways in for me. So I am a journalist and I spent many years working in newsrooms, writing for newspapers and magazines. And about 5 years ago now, I decided to make the leap and started working for myself. I published my first book back in 2023, which is called The Good Enough Job. And it's about work's relationship to our identities and how for so many of us, work and identity have become entwined. And I went on tour and I talked to so many people about this book, and I'd always get some variation of the same question, which is, how should I be thinking about my career when the future feels so uncertain? And some days I wanted to just pontificate on the future of work, but on my more honest days, I wanted to throw up my hand and say, I'm not sure, I don't know. And that tipped me off to the idea that maybe uncertainty and our tolerance for it is the most important meta skill that we could be developing in this current age.
Sara, how does uncertainty come up in therapy?
Honestly, it is probably one of the biggest topics that we would cover with the majority of my clients in the majority of their sessions. So we're talking about anxiety and fear. We're talking about past experiences that have informed how they might be approaching new experiences. And we're talking about their willingness to be open and confront new experiences. So it can absolutely come up in any aspect of my clients' lives. So yeah, keen to get into it.
Simone, I'm curious for your thoughts on uncertainty at this moment in time that we find ourselves, which I think is a funny cross-section, almost a contradictory cross-section of extreme uncertainty with certainty. I think that tech in the palm of our hands makes us feel sure a lot. We've got GPS guidance. We've got all sorts of apps to tell us what is the best choice to make for any kind of restaurant choice or any kind of life hack that we want, right? So there's kind of that certainty factor that tech gives us. But you zoom out, you know, we've got wars, we've got cost of living pressures, we've got fears of things like artificial intelligence. Tell me what you're seeing in this present moment when it comes to the sense of uncertainty.
You're absolutely right. And so there's two things going on. The first is that the world is becoming more uncertain. There's an economist from Stanford named Nicholas Bloom who's been tracking uncertainty since the early 80s. And since he began collecting data, the five highest measurements of global uncertainty have all occurred in the last 5 years. So between the pandemic, the shifting tariff policies, the rise of AI, some of these wars overseas, it's no secret that the world is incredibly uncertain right now. But there's another phenomenon that is less often talked about, which is that our intolerance of uncertainty is also on the rise. Many researchers attribute this to the rise of the internet, and more specifically, smartphones, which I think do two things. One, our phones bring all of the world's uncertainties into our pockets. And so now we can track the real-time updates of a war overseas or the real-time location of our children. But access to more information has not necessarily made us any wiser. It often just fuels our anxiety. The second thing that phones do is that they create the expectation that answers should be readily available. I don't know about you, but maybe 10 years ago, I would have been okay not knowing the name of a given actor. But now, because the information is in my pocket, I feel an almost involuntary need to reach for it right away. So the world is becoming more uncertain, our tolerance for uncertainty is in decline, and that's why I argue so many of us feel anxious and unmoored.
That sounds grim, Simone. Hopefully we can talk our way through this. Sara, I think we need some therapy from you. What are your thoughts on what Simone has just laid out for us?
I think that there's always been uncertainty in the world. But I think to Simone's point, we just have more access to information. And the more access to information that we have, the greater our expectation of predictability and certainty. So, for instance, people are going on holidays and they are planning their holidays using Instagram and then wanting to recreate some of the Instagrammable experiences overseas. Whereas in the ages prior to Instagram, people would just have more of a sense of openness to exploration. And this idea of having a goal to work towards, having something that they want to do, having access to more information means that we are going to have less of a tolerance to uncertainty and less of a willingness to, I guess, go about exploring and being curious and winging it.
Is that because there's an inbuilt sense of comparison when you're trying to model your holiday, for example, after what an influencer captured?
There's definitely that element as well. But I also think that, you know, when we are going into a new situation, whether that's traveling or a new job or a new relationship, we do kind of want a little bit of an idea of what to expect. Mm. And I don't think that that is completely unreasonable. I mean, you know, people used to buy travel books all the time, Lonely Planet, for instance. And this idea of at least I'll know, I'll be able to picture what to expect when I get there, that gave us somewhat of a sense of predictability. Now we have step-by-step guidelines of how to recreate Instagrammable moments. And I just find that fascinating because the more we rely on this information to get this sense of certainty, the less we're actually willing to step outside of that box and try something truly new.
Interesting. And on the line, we have Michelle in Sydney. Michelle, you called in because something happened in your life 17 years ago that really plunged you into the unknown. What was that?
You could say that, yes. It feels like 1,000 years ago now, but I was in my early 40s, and although I wasn't trying, I fell pregnant. And I was really fit at the time, and so that's possibly what helped me, but during a routine pregnancy examination, they discovered that I had a rare heart tumour, and I was 4 months pregnant and immediately thrown into, well, we have to rush you in for open heart surgery tomorrow. And I'm like, but I'm 4 months pregnant. What's going to happen to my baby? And the specialist, well, we actually don't know because this is such a rare tumour. It's actually, whilst open heart surgery has been performed on women all over the world, this particular surgery has never been performed on a pregnant woman, so we just don't know. And so at 43 years of age, my first child, it was awful. I did not want to lose a child, and at the same time, I didn't want to lose my life. So it was a terrifying prospect, an absolutely terrifying
prospect. Wow, Michelle, it sounds like you're here with us today, so you're okay, which is wonderful to hear. But that is double whammy on top of double whammy. Or, you know, that's two strikes of uncertainty. Can you take me back to that time and how you, what kind of headspace you were in and how you worked through it?
Look, I don't know that. All I can say is I had no choice. Initially I said, well, no, you're not going to, I'm not having the open surgery. You can just wait until the baby's born and then you can take it out. And I said, well, we can't do that because if we leave it in, the nature of the tumor is it can break up and embolize and cause, it can go anywhere and you will die and your baby will die. But at least this way, you will survive and maybe your baby will survive. And it was just so traumatic. I didn't have family here. My relationship was on the rocks. It was really, 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 really tough time. So I had to pretty much navigate that by myself and just have faith that everybody was in the room for all the right reasons and that the baby, because it was a world first, the operating theatre was filled with people, doctors watching the surgery. So my heart surgeon was under a bit of pressure to make sure it was a success. And I've just dropped my daughter to school this morning. So it worked. And she saved my life.
That is such an amazing story. Thank you so much for sharing. Before I let you go, just share with me finally, how do you think that experience of extreme uncertainty has shaped you in the aftermath when it comes to the unknown?
It sounds so cliched, but feel the fear and just move forward because there's no other choice. There is no other choice. You just have to bite down, take a big deep breath and move forward. And when you can get through it and get through the other side I'm alive and my baby's alive and everything is fine. I don't know. I'm babbling. I don't think I really
think
that I can offer.
Feel the fear and just move through it is a really beautiful encapsulation. And thank you. I'm sure a lot of people listening will be taking that with them today. I know I will. Sara O'Doherty, can I come to you and get your reflections on what Michelle has shared?
Absolutely. First of all, that sounds like such an awful choice to have to make. But I absolutely understand this idea of letting go of control. Pregnancy is one of those situations that a lot of my clients encounter. This idea of I need to let go of this sense of control, where their bodies are outside of their control. They might have a birth plan or an idea of how they want the pregnancy and the birth to go, but anything can happen. And it's about this idea of trust versus risk. And at some point, we have to take that risk and feel as though we can trust the experts in the room to do the best jobs that they can. And that trust and risk, they're on opposite sides of the same coin. In order to build that trust, that confidence, that reassurance for ourselves, we do need to practice risk-taking. And that might be small risks, controlled risks, or it might have to be, I'm going to have to take the plunge and feel as though I have no choice and just do the thing.
Simone, before we jump to our next caller who's standing by, I want to hear from you about what research says about what determines a person's ability to tolerate uncertainty. Is it nature? Is it nurture?
It's a combination of things. And just as Sara was saying, through evidence, we can build confidence over time. And so one of the follies of our modern age is because this uncertainty can be so quickly eradicated from our brains via technology or via the false certainty that gets peddled by experts or pundits on TV, we often are robbed of the practice of sitting with what we don't know. But like any tolerance, it's built through exposure. And so when we're willing to take those small risks, when we're willing to microdose uncertainty in different facets of our life, it better equips us to deal with the bigger uncertainties that we may face later.
Thank you. Let's go to Tina in Victoria. Tina, your guiding philosophy in life is leap and the net will appear. Tell me about how that came to you.
It's a lovely saying from Julia Cameron. Look, when I was 17, I went to America as an exchange student. At 21, I got married to my lovely husband, which I thought was way too young. At 30, I was pregnant and working while he was a full-time student. At 50, he died, and there was terrible, terrible court cases for 2 years. And at 60, I went to live in Italy, which was a complete disaster. But another favourite quote of mine is Michael Caine says, you know, when I die, I want to regret the things I did, not the things I didn't do. So that's probably been my guiding philosophy.
Tina, have you always been this courageous when it comes to risk?
I think so, yeah. I surfed when I was 13, you know, in treacherous waters with my brother. And, yeah, I'm quite conservative in my life, but I always think, oh, that looks like a good thing to do. I'll do that. You know, I'm curious.
What are the factors in your life you think that have helped you make those risks, take those risks and feel like, yeah, I'm going to be okay?
Well, I was just listening to the last caller and I thought, I'm from a great line of migrants. My grandmother's grandfather came from China. My dad came from Sicily. You know, my husband's family were Irish Catholic. I just think we're wanderers and we just think the next thing's going to be all right. You know, you have faith in people, you have faith in yourself. And like when I went to live in Italy, it was, you know, it wasn't the romantic dream like being on holiday there 3 times before. So I thought, no, that's not working. I'll just go home and plan my next move.
Tina, thank you so much. Really appreciate your philosophy on life. Simone Stolzoff, let me come to you for a comment because, I mean, Tina's perspective is so interesting because even when things haven't worked out, she seems to be quite okay with that. Mm. Whereas somebody else with a different mindset would really beat themselves up about it.
One distinction I like thinking about is the difference between one-way door versus two-way door decisions. The one-way door decisions are the decisions that are hard to reverse. Questions like, who should I marry or should I buy this house? But the majority of answers and decisions that we make in our life are actually two-way door decisions. They're decisions that if, like Tina, we decide to move to Italy and realize it was a grave mistake, we can walk back through that door and make a different choice. The problem occurs when we take the analytical, deliberative decision-making process that we might apply to a one-way door decision and try to apply it to a two-way door decision. That's when we get the rumination, the uncertainty, the analysis paralysis. And just like Tina's philosophy of leap and the net will appear, one thing that I like to think about is that action absorbs anxiety. It's only through taking steps, taking action, that the clarity often begins to emerge. So many times we think that we need to do all the research, make all the pro-con lists, talk to everyone who's been in a similar situation. But sometimes you do need that faith to be able to take action, even when you're not sure what outcome you might get.
I think it's a beautiful philosophy to have. But the little voice inside me is asking, well, what if you don't have a net? And I think we need to take a moment to consider whether even the ability to take a risk is a bit of a rich person's problem, if you know what I mean. So some people simply don't have nets, regardless of how much they want to strive for it. And when that's the case, how do we have to think about this, Simone? How do you consider that conundrum in all of your research?
You're absolutely right. You know, even having options or having choices is something that a certain level of privilege allows you to do. But the truth is, all of us have uncertainty in our lives. It's unavoidable. Those in a more precarious position might not be able to consider how much risk they're willing to tolerate, and they just have to do what they can day after day in order to get by. You know, I think about, you know, I've written this book called How to Not Know about the virtue of uncertainty. And yet it's not for every audience. If you give a book called How to Not Know to someone, say, fighting on the front lines of Ukraine, it's very different from a knowledge worker working in front of their computer in Sydney. And so one of the things that I like about the topic is that it's universal. All of us must face uncertainty, whether we like it or not. We don't have a choice. And by being able to develop the skills to develop our tolerance for it and become more skillful in the way that we approach the uncertainty of our life, we can more gracefully adapt to whatever the future may bring.
This is Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Beverly Wang, taking you through to 10 o'clock this morning. I'm speaking with Simone Stolzoff, who's got a new book out called How Not to Know, as well as Sara O'Doherty, a psychologist and president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Sara, I'd like to bring you in. What is this idea of analysis paralysis?
When we are focused on a problem, because our brains are very much geared towards looking towards the next challenge or the next problem, the next issue that we have to overcome. Our brains are problem-solving machines. We then might be able to look at what are the different options that I have in order to solve that problem. Now, the issue here is when we don't then take action, we're stuck in that rumination cycle of looking at the problem, looking at the various solutions, doing our pros and cons list, making plans, but maybe never actually translating those plans into action. And we end up in a state of extremely heightened anxiety, but also a bit of a freeze mode. We're not moving forward. We're not running away. We're just stuck. And that stuckness ends up being something that a lot of people find themselves in when they might not feel like they have the ability or the courage to move forward. And part of being able to move forward is picturing what I would do to cope in a particularly challenging situation. And if I can't picture that, then I don't have an idea of what I could actually do if or when that challenging situation arose.
Let's take a call from Helen in Queensland. Helen, you have dipped your toe into uncertainty with a new strategy for planning holidays. Tell me all about it.
Oh, well, in our relationship, I tend to be the person who does most of the planning. And just earlier this year, we were planning a trip to New Zealand and I was really busy with work. And I just thought, I can't cope with planning this trip. And my partner was busy with other things. So I just thought, right, we're just going to plan our first stop. And it ended up being a little town in New Zealand where I had some work colleagues and who were friends. And we just said, right, we're going to spend a few days there and then we'll just see what happens. And our whole trip, we spent 3 weeks just doing that, just sort of going from one place to another and just sort of seeing who we met, what stories we heard, and planning our next stop. And just now we're just away for a few days. We just had the opportunity for a friend to house sit and look after our doggies. And we've just done the same thing. And we've had the most amazing encounters with people. And we're up at Mount Glorious, only an hour and 40 minutes away from home. And with nature and with people. And for example, yesterday we just went to a cafe and not knowing if we were going to, my partner's quite fussy about cafes, not knowing if that was going to meet the standard, but it had such a great vibe. And while we were there, this group of musicians just came in who like just playing for no pay, and they were wonderful musicians. I'm Jewish, and one of the guys came over for a chat and happened to like klezmer music, so I got sort of regaled with klezmer music. And and in the afternoon just went for a walk down the road from where we're staying and found this amazing sculpture garden, and the person who runs it ended up having this, you know, quite long philosophical discussion, and we're going back there this morning to help with some garden maintenance.
That sounds like a lot of fun, Helen. And as a person who plans every single stop on a multi-stop holiday, you're making me think again about how I plan holidays. I'll keep you posted what I do next time. But how do you think... Do you think that this attitude to just planning the first stop of your holiday is going to transfer into other aspects of your life?
I think it has already. I think it does help me cope with not being, I need to be in control of everything. Because, of course, you know, as your guests have said, you know, we're not in control of, you know, it's an illusion. And so, yeah, I think I'm just far more relaxed about going with the flow. And also, we're in our 60s now, so this approach of holidays as well is like going back to the future. Like when you jump in a car with a tent and road and kind of know where we're going, north or south or west or whatever, and just sort of see what happened.
Wonderful,
and
Helen.
Yeah, so I think totally the digital thing has made us feel like we have to plan everything and we're somehow incompetent if we don't.
Yeah. Denise in Narm, Melbourne, is our next caller. Denise, you've lived a life that's been full of situations where you had to deal with uncertainty. What have you learned from those experiences?
I think I've learned that I had strength that I didn't know about. I mean, I was quite a shy young person. Luckily, had a beautiful partner in my life, and we had our three children by the time I was 26. But when I was 32, we were in a car accident. My husband and one of my children died, and I was badly injured, so I was hospitalised for 10 months with broken neck and fractured skull and da-da-da, the whole range of things. And my parents were told I'd probably never walk or talk again. But I had a great incentive to parent my children, luckily for me, and great medical care. Not only was I able to walk and talk again, but I was able to parent them, and also decided that my attitude to change and to challenge had changed. I found a strength. And so I chose to go back to uni and study social work, not because I have the answers for other people, but I think that I can help people find their strength and they can find their answers. So I'm 70 now. That was, you know, a long, long time ago. But of course, it shapes me, and it's made me not fear change, and to appreciate and recognize that everyone has strengths within them that often you don't know about.
Absolutely, Denise. That's so horrific, that tragic loss, and I'm really sorry. Thank you for sharing. And yes, I imagine being in those depths of grief and loss and your own injury would give you a really different perspective on uncertainty. Do you remember a moment or an example where you felt like, you would make it through?
Well, I was unconscious for 6 weeks, and so the family were doing a 24-hour sitting with me. And when I became conscious, I hadn't realised what had happened. Luckily for me, I don't have a memory of the accident, which I'm sort of glad of. And it took me some time, and I eventually mouthed the, you know, where are Greg and Ben, and was told that I had to really... work out whether I wanted to recover, really. That was the truth. Yeah. And having decided that I did, because I still had my gorgeous two, my 12-year-old and 6-year-old boys that I wanted to be a parent to, I think that was my turning point. That was my decision, and luckily the medical system helped me to get there as well. So, yes.
Denise, thank you so much, and go well. Thank you so much for sharing. Really appreciate it. Sara Doherty, I'd like to come to you, not just to comment on the incredible story that our caller just shared with us, but also to get your thoughts on how we actually build up our uncertainty tolerance.
So what's come through really strongly, not just with that caller, but with the previous callers as well, is a lot of our guiding principles our values are what is supporting us to be resilient and to be strong. So when we talk about values, we're talking about the kinds of really important facets of ourselves, our belief in ourselves, and what really matters in our everyday. And the kinds of values that are coming through are things like openness to experiences, courageousness, curiosity, and also that recognition of one's own strength. And being able to recognize that I can get through really challenging times, and so therefore I will get through the next really challenging time, that absolutely supports us to build our confidence and therefore building our tolerance to uncertainty. The more we feel capable of managing change, of being able to get through really difficult situations, be able to either, you know, land with that support net or land on our feet on the other side, allows us to then take risks or make changes that might ordinarily feel a little bit anxiety provoking or even scary.
And Simone, where did your research take you when you went looking for thinkers or examples of how to build up an uncertainty tolerance?
I really like what Sarah just said. You know, one of the principles from the book is that when we are certain about some aspects of our life, it makes it easier to hold uncertainty in others. So one of the pieces of advice that I give is to find your anchors. Your anchors can be something like your values, these boulders that will remain constant even as the winds swirl around you. They can be a commitment to live in a particular place, a commitment if you're a business owner to fulfill a particular mission, or maybe a commitment to a particular spouse. But the idea here is we can start with what we know will hopefully hold true. The second thing I often say is to focus on the next right action. There's this concept in Buddhism that I really like about focusing on the next right action, because so often when faced with uncertainty, we have this natural tendency to catastrophize. The metaphor I like is that facing uncertainty can feel like you're sitting on a rowboat on a lake that's shrouded in very heavy fog. You might not be able to see very far in front of you or know exactly where you'll end up, but you have two jobs. The first is to maintain faith that you'll eventually reach land. And the second is to keep rowing. And it's through that rowing, it's through that action that we begin to build confidence in ourselves that the path will emerge.
Let's take a call from Luke in Queensland. Welcome to Life Matters, Luke. You had a moment in your life where you had to completely pivot and change direction. What helped you get through that uncertainty?
Just to give you a quick summary of what happened is that I went to a return flight to America in California, where I was living at the time. I had a job, had a girlfriend, and I was on my way there and stopped at the airport and in San Francisco, and I got a visa refusal. There was visa complications there. So one minute I had my whole mindset focused on moving forward. The next minute I'm on my way back to Sydney. And so I had to learn to accept the situation very quickly. And what actually helped me get through it was this book called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. And it was a real game changer, because I had no real backup. I was quite young. I was in my early 20s. I had no backup, security blanket as far as family go. It was all my family were in America at the time. So I had to be very quick to learn what helped me learn that was that there really is no future. It's what you're doing now. And I think that the biggest problem that we have is this fear of the unknown. It's trying to formulate a future plan when there's never been a future. It's all the future really is a string of now moments all put together. And if we focus on where we are now, then we're more prepared to be ready for the future. And the thing was as well, if I wouldn't mind adding, the strange thing with the flip side to this is that change in direction, it actually pushed me into another path, which opened a whole lot of new doors that was actually the best thing for me. So quite often we think that it's a bad thing that happens, but quite often it can open doors and it can be a blessing in disguise as well.
You've shared a lot of great ideas for us to take with us and think about today, Luke. I guess I just am craving a postscript. What happened? Were you able to get back to California, or did you end up staying in Australia?
No, that was it. The door closed. Mm. That was it. So that's why it was such a hard one for me, because I had family. I had a girlfriend that was getting quite serious at the time as well. So I knew as soon as it happened, I needed to accept what is happening right now very quickly, and then I could be clear about where I'm going forward. So.
Thank you so much for sharing. What an interesting story, and lots to think about in terms of. Sarah, I want to come to you, because what Luke's kind of pointing out is that I think we have control. We try to map things out, but in reality, there's so many things that could happen at any given moment that can throw us off of our chosen path. And that realization can be very unsettling, but how can it also be helpful?
100%. I think that there is, we again have a tendency to plan, to want to problem solve, to want to sort of have this idea of where we're going to and how we're going to be moving forward. But being able to navigate any of those little changes and roll with the punches, that becomes a skill that we develop through practice and through resilience. And part of what we need to be doing, I guess, in this problem-solving process that we're going through, multiple times, probably even hundreds of times a day, is actually stopping at the end of that process and reflecting on what happened? What did I do well? What's repeatable? How would I like to take that forward? And I think a lot of us forget that positive self-reflection piece at the end of it, because we're so busy jumping from one problem to the next problem that we're not taking the time to pause, to reflect, to actually analyze what did I do well and how does that reflect on me as a person and my character and also my strength and ability to move forward.
Simone Stolzoff, I want to come to you for some final thoughts. You know, in this world that is so oriented to finding solutions and feeling certain and feeling like a winner at life, whatever that means, what is your, I guess, call to arms for being more open to embracing uncertainty?
I'll share a brief story from a friend of mine named Emily that I think gets at the heart of the wisdom that we can take forward, which is when Emily was in her early 20s, her mom was given this potentially terminal diagnosis, and she was really struggling to cope. And one day, a family friend of hers named Bill came to visit the two of them in the hospital and asked Emily, "How are you doing?" And Emily said, "Honestly, Bill, I'm not doing very well. I am riding this roller coaster of anticipatory grief and fear, and I'm terrified of what might happen to my mom." And Bill said something very wise. He said, "Emily, the version of you that will handle that tragic event, if or when it ever takes place, will be born into existence in that moment. And that version of you will have more information, more context, and be better equipped to handle that than you are today. You have to trust in your future self's ability to handle your future problems." And so maybe that's one piece of wisdom we can all take. It's from Emily Anhalt, who is also a clinical psychologist and author. And I love this idea of trusting in our future selves, because it grounds us in what we can control in the now, as Luke very beautifully said. And it also prevents us from prematurely suffering about something that may never come to be.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to squeeze in one final call from Anita. Anita, welcome to Life Matters. I'm going to have to ask you to keep it quick, but your swim with humpback whales confirmed the way you want to move through life. Tell me more.
Very much so. I've had a number of traumatic experiences, and I sort of was given this opportunity to swim with humpback whales in Tonga, and we actually had to sign a piece of paper to say that we knew it could be fatal. but it was the most humbling, unbelievably beautiful experience to be in with, say, a three-week-old calf with this huge eye looking at us, and his mother coming up later, who was absolutely enormous. And so I swam five times with different humpback whales, and I just would advise people to, yes, life can be difficult. Life can throw difficult things at us, but it can also throw wonderful, wonderful experiences if you take that risk and if you take that plunge.
Anita, thank you so much for being our last caller this morning on Life Matters and sharing that experience with us. I also want to thank my guest this morning, Simone Stolzoff, a journalist and author of The Good Enough Job, What We Gain When We Don't Put Work First, and more recently, How to Not Know the Value of Uncertainty in a World that Demands Answers. And Sara O'Doherty is a psychologist and president of the Australian Association of Psychologists. Thank you both for all your time. The next up, the aunties consider a break in trust in friendship.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson
one nation's
is maybe
rise.
It's one nation.
This is the unlikely story of one nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of one nation. Follow the series on ABC Radio National Sunday Extra or available anytime on ABC Listen.
When your chosen family aren't making the cut, can you unchoose them? Let's ask Auntie. I want to welcome two members of our chosen family who would never let us down, comedian Annie Louie and broadcaster with ABC Canberra, James Findlay. Aunties, welcome back.
Hello, welcome to you too.
Great to be here.
Auntie Annie, do you have what you call a chosen family?
I don't, because I am hyper independent and I do everything. It's me, myself and I. And I think if I could choose an emergency contact at this point, it would be my dog.
You can put me down. Okay.
Oh, okay. Great.
All right. James, same question to you. Do you have a chosen family? How do you show up for each other?
Look, I don't have a chosen family. I there's definitely people. I've moved around a lot, mm-hmm. as you know, the past, 10 years. There are always people that I can call upon, but when it comes to chosen family, no. I have a family that acts like a family in the way that, you know, we don't really have a lot in common or get along if we talk about anything outside of, you know, the weather, but we always are there for each other.
Wow, bragging, James. let's see how our letter writer M's chosen family works for her. She writes, what a lot of my best friends have in common is that none of us are very close with our biological families. That means when any of us need family stuff, a lift to the hospital or the airport, care during illness, help moving house, or next of kin forms, we've always been there for each other. A few years ago, we decided to formalize the arrangement by calling ourselves the Love Cone, which makes me think of the Love Shack by the B-52s, but that's by the by. James, gut response to what we just heard. Does a Love Cone sound nice to you?
No. This is, look, how lovely for these friends to be there for each other. But it does sound, dare I say, a little culty. But, you know, if that's what you're into, then go for it, I guess.
Okay, James, let's keep an open mind on behalf of M, please. Annie, how does the Love Cone sound to you?
It's an adorable phrase. I've never heard of the Love Cone, but it also sounds like Cone of Silence. Like, it sounds like, you know, there's a lot of secrets tightly held within the group.
The Love Cone is that place where, you know, we can get together and I won't say anything else. Do you, Annie, okay, it's great. You both have very oppositional responses to the Love Cone. Annie, do you think that any unexpected problems could arise from this arrangement?
It does sound very clingy. Like, do they all not have emergency contacts of their own, that they're really stuck together?
Where's their dog to call?
Yeah, where's their? Yeah, exactly. But I totally understand that, like, let's say you have bad relationships with your family, that you will need somebody to help you out with all those things. And these are huge milestone events. Like, for instance, I try to move house by myself. It's never going to work. No. I do need to ask for help.
Yeah. James, you're a bit of a cynic on the love cone, so I really want to hear what you think, how you think it could go wrong.
Well, I do wonder why they felt it was appropriate or needed to formalize such a friendship in some kind of agreement. You know, if you're all just there for each other, aren't you just there for each other without having to call yourselves a group?
Is that called friends?
Maybe, but yeah. What's your friendship group called?
Don't have a name
Jukebox
for it.
Jukebox Money?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, some group chats have names, but that's not what we call ourselves when we get together. I am curious about what this formalized arrangement looks like. Is it an MOU? Is it a binding legal agreement? Have they written things down? I am really curious about what formal means.
Anyway. Maybe it's like the iTunes agreement. There's like 17 to 70 pages you've never read before. You didn't know what you were signing off on when you agreed.
Maybe and you're all forced to listen to that U2 album.
Or maybe you can buy it at the post office.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Exactly.
Fill in your own love cone agreement. Em, love you. Love you. We're just having a bit of fun. Okay. Aunties, let's go back to Em's story. Em says, last year, a newer friend asked if she could be made part of the group. We'd all grown close to her during COVID. The vibe felt right, so we started inviting her to all our close hangs and helping her out. But a few months ago, she started a new relationship and ever since has been completely MIA. Texts are ignored, she stopped coming to things, and recently, when we all made meals for a friend who'd been sick, she just didn't respond. Annie, what a turn.
Oof.
For such a committed arrangement, though, what do you think of vibes be the decision maker on whether you let someone into your cone of love?
Oh, yeah. I have definitely experienced losing friends to relationships, and when they break up, they come crawling back. I'm like, here we go. So I think you do get so many chances with me. I love the number 3. You know, 3 is the magic number. If you come back within that time, then yeah, well, you're welcome back. No questions
asked.
Those
are your terms and conditions.
That's my terms and conditions.
Are they articulated or are they just rest in your
mind?
They
rest in my mind. But now the whole nation knows. I have a strike counter.
It's got a strike system. James, what do you think of adding a new member to the Love Cone kind of as a late joiner?
Yeah, look, it is always can be a little bit rocky when you add someone into your inner circle, your love cone, love shack situation. But it sounds like this person's already tapped out. But so, you know, if there's you know, texts going unanswered, not like pitching in with the cooking, sounds like they've got other things on their mind. But on the other hand, this does sound like a classic family vibe where there's always someone in your family that isn't really there for you.
Yeah, the person who doesn't respond to your messages, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, Auntie Janice, where are you? You know, so I feel like this is quite on brand for a family.
Okay, so do you think status quo, just let Em's friend, the new joiner to the Love Cone, be a kind of a silent member of the family for a little while? Let it run its course.
Well, yeah, but I still have a problem with the unanswered texts.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess we do also have that friend that you'll text and then like 3 weeks later we'll go, oh, sorry, I forgot to get back to this.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but it really depends on what was in that agreement.
Yes.
But look, if they're not replying, it sounds like they're tapping out. Maybe they saw a look into the love cone and thought, Don't know if this is for me.
Get me out of the cone. Okay, let's get to part 3. Let's see how else M's situation has played out. M writes, I get that the honeymoon period of any new relationship is all-encompassing and exciting, but it's been going on for a few months now and it feels hurtful. The whole idea of the love cone is to show up in the way we'd expect family to. We've already spoken to her about how much this is disrupting the connection of the group, but are wondering how many times we should let it happen before saying, hey, maybe this love cone is just not for you. I mean, Annie, you've been pretty clear. 3 strikes.
Yeah, it's great for people who run late as well. It's 3 strikes. Like, you know, more than half an hour? No, you're done as
more than
a friend.
Half an wow, that is a long time.
It is a long time. I'm quite generous.
Do you text in that half an hour or do you just let it?
Do they tell you that they're running late?
Yeah, usually, but I still think it's unacceptable.
Right, okay. James, what do you think of M's conundrum of whether to rule on love cone abandonment or love cone second chances?
Yeah, look, Beverly, you know, I feel like you know where I'm going to go with this.
Go for it. Lay it on me.
Confront. Yeah. Confront said person.
Confront.
Yeah. Yeah. Why aren't you replying to my texts? Why aren't you pitching in? Do you even want to be part of the love cone? If you don't, that's okay. You don't have to be here. but we all stand up, we all look after each other, and you're not looking after us, maybe you don't have to be here.
What is a way to maintain a friendship with this, I suppose, delinquent member of the love cone without having them be in the love cone, Annie?
I'm the opposite. I'm conflict avoidant. So I would be like, I can only assume that I'm not part of the priorities anymore and that our group is not. So I'm happy to never respond.
So you're in the perspective, you're speaking from the perspective of the M's friend, the late joiner.
From the perspective of the people in the cone, if I've tried and I'm not hearing back from them, I'm just going to let that drift away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than like James, what he has said, that's fantastic. I wish I was that brave, but I wouldn't directly ask anyone, why haven't you responded to my texts? In fact, I was going to suggest maybe faking a huge event, like someone's in hospital. You know, I'd rather go to those lengths just to test them.
Just to see if they
come. Yeah, if they come back, lure them back. Maybe a funeral, something dramatic.
So it's like an entrapment third strike.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
the final one is like major drama.
Well, I'd love to see both of those situations unfold, actually. I mean, James, being someone who's fond of just taking the bull by the horns, how has it worked out for you when you've been so direct and asking people? Yeah.
Well, I always get an answer, but there's usually an answer. Like, I don't know. Like, it's not as if I'm like that. I'm tactful with my confrontation.
Okay.
Do you think the people?
There is some tact there.
Okay. Do they lie to you though when they respond? Do you have a feeling?
Do you see the fear in their eyes?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I feel like people are always honest with me because I'm always honest with them.
Yeah.
So this is where I would want said person to be, you know, maybe they just don't want to be there anymore. But at least you're not wondering anymore, you know. You're not wondering whether they should be there or not.
Okay.
And, you know, having to go to all that effort to put on a fake funeral.
I'm already making bookings.
Is there a third, is there any, just before we let go, is there another option that you want to put on the table?
Hmm.
I mean, here's a text. Here's a bit of a grim thought from one texter. Mm. The friend could be in trouble. Maybe in a bad. The bad relationship is bad.
This is why I'm like
reaching out.
Confront. Maybe they'll tell you that they're in trouble.
Mm. I think taking it off the platform. Like if it was text, you need to go ring them, or you know where they live. Go suss them out. You know, in person, not stalk them, but like you know, maybe that is the case, and they don't like texting, or there's something that they. Yeah, it's sometimes you can get quickly into an argument over text.
Well, hope you're listening in. Otherwise, catch up on ABC Listen. Lots of options for you there on how to solve the dilemma or just start a conversation about what's happening in the love cone situation or, you know, taking Annie Louie's advice, either ignore or stage a really elaborate fake funeral, whichever you like. Annie Louie is hosting a new monthly comedy night in Melbourne at the Comedy Sanctuary. She'll be there next August 22nd, and you can go online for more information. Sure to be a good time if Annie is involved. And broadcaster with ABC Canberra, James Finlay, the most direct man on the radio. Thank you so much. Thank you to Em. If you have a dilemma that you want to share with Life Matters and our wonderful aunties, please write to lifematters@abc.net.au. Put Ask Auntie in the subject line. And a big thank you to Life Matters producers who bring you all the stories and interviews you hear across the week. They are Jack McDonald, Bronwyn O'Shea, Grace Pashley, Beck Zajac, and our executive producer, Lachlan McIntosh. Our audio engineer is Carrie Dell, and you can find all Life Matters episodes on ABC Listen. Search for Life Matters, tap the heart to follow. You'll be all set. I'm Beverly Wang. Catch you again next week.